Being sure with Pure. The Pure Oil Company presents H.V. Kaltenborn, Dean of American News Commentators, with the news and his own analysis of current events. When you see a lot of people all looking at something, your own interest is immediately aroused. The petroleum industry is a lot of people looking at a pretty big and complicated thing. For crude petroleum comes from as deep in the earth as man has explored, and its products go as high in the sky as man has flown. You've been hearing a lot about the part petroleum products, pure oils, for example, are going to play in our post-war lives. But what about petroleum's underground? What's the post-war picture on oil reserves? As a nation at war, we're using up our oil faster than we're finding new oil. But men are still finding new oil and inventing new ways to find more. The record of pure oil geologists is exceptional. Pure oil's reserves are larger than they were at the start of the war. Tireless search and the use of the most modern scientific tools achieved this pure oil record of new oil discovery. And pure oil's growing oil reserve means an ever-growing resource behind that famous promise, be sure with pure. Now, the Pure Oil Company brings you H.V. Kaltenborn.
Good evening, everybody. A bulletin has just come in that tells us that the United States 3rd Carrier Fleet planes have launched attacks in strength against the Honshu Naval Sea Base of Kure. The attacks are continuing. This important base on southern Honshu is opposite Kyushu and Shikoku Islands. It guards the western entrance to the inland sea and is one of Japan's most important bases. Thus, the main part of the 3rd Fleet appears to have moved some hundreds of miles to the south since it was last heard from. This carries the 3rd Fleet's air-sea onslaught against Japan into its third week. The attacks on the inland sea base began at dawn today. Admiral Nimitz also announced that light units of the Pacific Fleet on Sunday steamed up to the China coast off Chikyang Province to sink several small Japanese ships. Far to the north, other light units bombarded Japanese installations on Paramushiro in the Kuril Islands. Thus, the United States Pacific Fleet was in action at the same time at three points 2,600 miles apart. Up to Thursday, Halsey's 3rd Fleet had destroyed or damaged 412 ships and 556 planes. Far Eastern Air Force fighters and bombers have sunk 10 enemy craft and damaged at least 109. This is in new blows against Japanese sea communications from the China coast to the Dutch East Indies. If the Japanese radio has received orders to prepare the Japanese people for surrender, it is carrying out those orders most effectively. Hardly a day has passed since the loss of Okinawa, in which Tokyo broadcasters have not radiated pessimism. They have emphasized our strength and Japan's weakness. They have said many times that Japan's only chance for a successful defensive is at home. This amounts to writing off all conquests and preparing the people to accept defeat. Today again, Japan warns her people about the unfavorable results of the Big Three conference. Japan's envoys in Moscow may have had news from that conference which has not yet reached us. For the third time in 10 days, Japan's foreign minister has reported to Emperor Hirohito on certain secret negotiations which are now underway. A Tokyo newspaper today warns Japan that a break with Russia may result from the Potsdam conclusions. It says that Japanese people must be prepared, even at this time, for the eventuality that the communique issued upon the conclusion of the Big Three conference will include provisions most unfavorable for Japan. What that means to the Japanese who hears it is war with Russia. There is no official news from the closely guarded Big Three meeting place in Potsdam. All we are told is that the chief delegates held their usual meeting and that Prime Minister Churchill was host tonight at what may be the final state dinner for President Truman and Premier Stalin. Roy Porter, NBC's correspondent, has just told us from Berlin that the conference is nearing its end. The closing date is fixed. Part of the American delegation has already left Berlin. And the Americans, we are told, have left for a new and surprising destination. Is it Moscow? Is it Chongqing? Does it have some relation to Russia's participation in the war against Japan? President Truman has wanted to speed up the conference and seems to be getting his wish. We are told that he is urging his colleagues to make firm decisions without extensive arguments. This may be desirable, but it is certainly difficult. There is some speculation that the Big Three talks might end when Churchill goes home on Thursday to receive results of the parliamentary election. Certainly, if the Big Three are going to settle any large number of the problems they now face in Europe, they would have to continue their sessions into August. So they may have decided to let the conference carry on without them. Perhaps the big three will go home, and their not-so-big assistants will carry on at some point more friendly than Berlin. The most important decision the big three could make is how to get problems settled without participation of government heads in every settlement, because that would mean speed. American forces arrested more than 80,000 Germans in a gigantic 48-hour raid covering the entire American occupation zone. All roads were blocked and almost every house in an area occupied by 15 million persons was searched. It took about 500,000 American soldiers to do the job. Some of those arrested had contraband articles. Many persons lacked proper identification papers. All were placed in prison cages pending trial or further investigation. Many have already been released. Among those picked up were American soldiers absent without leave and apparently trying to avoid redeployment to the Pacific. One purpose of the cleanup was an effort to wipe out a potential black market in the American zone. It is the lawless elements throughout Europe, both American and European, that have been most prominent in organizing black markets. During my stay in Rome and Paris last winter, I heard a lot about black market operations in United States Army supplies. With everything in scant supply, American soldiers can get almost anything in exchange for food, articles, clothing, or cigarettes. Today, with the war over, the lure of profit and excitement presents an even greater temptation. It will take more than one raid to hold down the black market. Orders for the cleanup went out 3 weeks ago. The Germans knew nothing about it when it was called out and carried out over the weekend. This testifies to good security in the American occupation zone. Minor offenses were charged against most of those arrested. There were a few instances where the accused possessed contraband material. There was little violence. The cleanup was timed to coincide with the end of a one-week period of grace, during which Germans were permitted to turn in weapons and other contraband without penalty. Brigadier General Edwin L. Seiber, chief of the intelligence section of our occupation forces, said quick entry into German homes gave some interesting sidelights on fraternization. He said, one of the very few bugs we found in the search was the disposition of soldiers to linger over the questioning of pretty girls. Colonel Thomas Sands, chief of our counterintelligence, was asked about Dr. Goebbels' Nazi werewolves who were supposed to carry out underground sabotage. He said, there is no such thing. There is just a small, badly organized criminal element which would like to call itself by that name. It is a serious mistake to do so. I hope American papers will never use the werewolf description again. In Berlin today, a ranking military government officer said that food is scarce now and will be even more scarce soon. He said the Allied policy in feeding Germany is simple. Germany is going to feed Germany. Considering the fact that Germany was never self-sufficient in food and is less self-sufficient now than ever before, it will not be simple to carry this policy into effect. The Allied Control Commission does not have any accurate figures on food now available. For this reason, it is impossible to tell to what extent the Berlin area could be self-sustaining. War damage to transport lands is muddling both food and fuel supply problems. For the present, Berlin is more or less isolated. There is only a limited exchange of food and fuel between the occupation zones. Americans have sent some food and cattle into Berlin all the way from Bavaria, and the British are sending some coal and fish from the coastal regions. This because of the rather foolish arrangement that each one of the three occupying powers has to feed its own particular section of Berlin. That is one thing that we hope will be cleared up by the meeting of the big three. Americans and British have assumed responsibility for feeding their share of the Berlin population. Food goes into a pool and is distributed to retailers for sale under a Russian rationing system. Vasily Kuznetsov, head of the Russian trade union movement, gave an unusually frank interview in Washington tonight. He arrived Saturday with nine other Russian trade union delegates. They will be the guests of the CIO on a tour of war plants. Kuznetsov brought an invitation to the CIO to visit Russia. He said the AFL attitude of refusing to join a World Trade Organization with the Russians was completely wrong. He claimed that the Russian trade union movement was the most democratic in the world. I have just read the objective report of Sir Walter Citrine, British trade union leader, on labor unions in Russia. If you're interested, get his book. He says the Russian labor unions are creatures of the Russian government in exploiting Russian labor. That's what he told the Russian trade union leaders to their faces. I hope our CIO leaders, including the able Phil Murray, will go to Russia and bring back an up-to-date report. We need factual information on what is going on in Russia. Marshal Pétain is on trial for his life. the victor of Verdun and former Vichy government chief, faced a French trial which had as much of a propaganda purpose as the recent trial of the 15 Poles in Moscow. And it is just about as certain to result in conviction. The courtroom was crowded. Frenchmen booed and jeered proceedings, as Frenchmen will, and attorneys wrangled fiercely, as attorneys usually do on big occasions. At one point, the courtroom was ordered closed. The often postponed trial will last at least 2 weeks. It is supposed to furnish a sort of supreme review of the charges which, for years, French patriots have leveled against other Frenchmen whom they accuse of collaborating with the Germans. 50,000 Frenchmen are still in jail, awaiting trial on such charges. Pétain bore up well, considering the weight of his 89 years. He defended himself in a firm, clear voice after the act of accusation was read. He declared, "I was the heir of a catastrophe of which I was not the author. Every day I struggled against the enemy with a dagger at my throat." Reynaud was the first witness for the prosecution. In his long statement, he charged that Pétain and General Maxime Weygand, blinded by political hatreds, had put every obstacle in his way for continuing the war against Germany. It is not the business of an American to take sides when France accuses a marshal of France of being a traitor. But Americans, who know the recent history of Franco-American relations, know that the Roosevelt administration was never anti-Pétain. It was anti-Laval. President Roosevelt always distinguished between what was done by Vice Premier Laval and what was done by the old marshal. He made this clear in a letter he wrote Admiral Ley on December 20th, 1940. My own feeling is that Pétain was never willingly pro-German. On fundamentals, such as keeping the French fleet out of German hands, he remained pro-Allied. But he was not strong enough, mentally or physically, to resist German pressure. And he was also authoritarian and anti-democratic. He may have been a traitor to the Third Republic, or to the de Gaulle government in Africa. But the one had disappeared, and the other had not yet been recognized. The real question is whether he was a traitor to France. I am willing to withhold judgment on that question until the evidence is in. And Admiral Leahy could supply a very important part of that evidence. Unfortunately, the interests of the United States will not permit one who is so close to the President of the United States to participate in a trial in which so much emotion, so much is involved for the government of France. The two senators who helped write the United Nations World Security Charter at San Francisco pleaded with their colleagues today for early ratification. Chairman Tom Connally, Democrat of Texas, of the Foreign Relations Committee, and Senator Arthur Vandenberg, Republican of Michigan, brought the treaty to the floor of the Senate. A ratification vote is expected later this week. They spoke to jammed galleries and to an almost empty Senate. For the issue is decided. We'll join. Good night.